can be happy the rest of my life. My ass is leaking. Are we still recording?
Yeah. Okay. Is it really leaking? You can feel it?
It's actually improved greatly since I had the surgery, but it's still, I mean, this is a hard chair. I've been sitting on it for a while.
You want a pillow?
No, I'm good.
Hello and welcome to another installment of the New and Improved Greater Fool podcast. My name is Dylan Schwartz.
And I'm Danny Pellegrini.
How's everybody doing out there? I just want to say thank you for everybody that's been subscribing, everybody that's been listening. We appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
So what's going on with me? Well, right now, my wife and I have not really been spending that much time together. Because she's been down in New York working a lot. Kelly is a tattoo artist, and there's a lot of demand for her work in the city, and she keeps getting more and more opportunity. And meanwhile, I'm in Boston, where we have our place and where my job is. Ultimately, the plan is for both of us to be in New York, but right now the circumstances aren't such that we can make that happen. It's not the most ideal situation for us to be in, but so far we're making it work. And I think her and I owe a lot of that to the fact that we've really spent a lot of time trying to understand what we need from each other when we communicate. We aren't physically around each other as much as we'd like or as much as it is probably necessary to maintain the intimacy that keeps a relationship going. So what we really have when we're apart is talking with one another. Since we're in this kind of like limbo state right now, inherently there's a lot of frustration that bubbles up on both sides. And annoyance with the situation, it can easily steer our conversation into an angry place. Her desire or my desire to control the timeline that we're working with or what we need to be doing to make this move happen can really pollute conversation in a way that could damage the relationship. And don't get me wrong, our conversations are not void of that. It definitely happens. But we're able to bring it back to a place where we kind of slow down. We listen to each other and allow ourselves to be vulnerable when we're talking about challenging, emotionally charged things. The story of how her and I initially met and how we got married is for another time, but it, like this situation, was not totally ideal. It seems to be a theme in our relationship. I don't want to put this idea out there that we faced some type of immense hardship, but it was challenging in its own way. And it was during that time, when we were first living together and making the decision to get married, that I got a kind of wake-up call about the way I communicate. You know, I kind of always had this perception of myself as a raw, open book kind of person who had no problem being revealing, but I found out that wasn't really the case. Just because I wasn't scared to say exactly what I was thinking didn't necessarily mean I was being honest. The way I spoke usually didn't add to a conversation that's ultimate goal was to arrive at some type of compromise. Saying exactly what I felt was usually rooted in my desire to subtly manipulate the outcome of whatever we were talking about in my favor so that I could continue to stay comfortable. All that really resulted from that was me temporarily maintaining my way, you know, what I was comfortable with. But nothing was ever resolved. No growth around the relationship would occur. And in my heart of hearts, I knew that that wasn't what I wanted. You know, I didn't know how the relationship was going to go. I didn't know if we were going to stay together or if we were going to go our separate ways or whatever. But I knew that continuing to talk in the way I was talking when we were having those critical conversations, it was not going to result in any kind of movement. It wasn't until I stopped letting a defensive or nervous reaction inform what I was going to say in one of these important conversations that the nature of our conversations changed. What happened was is the conversations became quieter and slower. No one was trying to win the conversation. We were both helping each other sort through our feelings, even though they may have been divergent at times. And once that vulnerability became a part of how we talked, we were able to face the challenges of our situation and ultimately get through them. You know, nowadays, there's so many ways that allow us to show the people in our lives and the world at large who we are, which is great, but it's also very one-sided. What happens is we can project whatever truth about ourselves we want. Sure, we can receive feedback via comments or DMs or whatever, but that's not the same as the intimacy of a real conversation. I know from my own experience that people have always struggled with making themselves vulnerable when communicating in the context of the important relationships in their lives, romantic, friendship, or professional. But I think all these social media platforms and the way so much of the media, TV, and movies paints the picture of what it means for a person to be open and revealing has made getting to that place of real honesty with another person that much more confusing and elusive. The story that Danny is going to read on this episode of A Greater Fool Speaks, in my mind, hits on all this stuff in a really unique way. He illustrates how beautiful it can be when two people let their guard down. Was that crap or was that good? Did that make any sense?
No. It made perfect sense. But it's funny because I know that you weren't like deliberately trying to necessarily lead into the story, but I was kind of thinking that as you were speaking. I was like, well, where's he going with this? But I said, the story is kind of about connection between people, and I'm gonna jump right into it. This is actually, this is from a journal entry from exactly a year ago. What do you know? This is from May 7th, 2016. That's a year ago today. This is pretty short compared to the others that we've read. It's just a few pages long, but it's kind of an essay. I think it's kind of funny. It's from May 7th, 2016, and I've titled this At the Movies. The rule in movie theaters is this: when the lights go down, it's time to stop talking and bring your attention to the screen. There's also an unwritten rule that works in tandem with that. While waiting for the film to begin, hushed voices are preferred. This is observed in most dimly lit spaces, such as fine dining restaurants, say, or funeral parlors. The amount of light directly correlates with speaking volume. When I'm inside Target, which is lit like an operating room, I have no problem cupping my hand around my mouth and shouting to my wife, three aisles over, to remember the preparation H. But in low light, I have a natural tendency to whisper, giving the most trivial subjects, like basement dehumidifiers or 0% APR financing, a clandestine and revelatory aura. Some people are unaware of this rule, or they choose to ignore it. These are the ones in the museum, screeching so loud that even the oil paintings cringe, or the guy who steps into the elevator with his phone to his ear, making plans with someone named Bro and assuring him that everything is all good, while five strangers are sardined around him, fantasizing about his gruesome death. Maybe it's the power trip that comes with hijacking a ready-made audience, but I've never understood loud talkers. Call it paranoia or delusion, but I don't want any unintended recipients hearing my conversation. Partly it's out of respect for those within earshot, but mostly it's because I'm weirdly protective of my thoughts. Do I really want the table next to me to know that I've invented a new laugh, one that's modeled after the theme from Entertainment Tonight? Or my stance on tax reform, which I memorized from a Facebook post I read earlier that morning? If you're going to command a space with your conversation, at least make an effort to use compelling material. On a recent flight from Palm Beach, two weightlifting buddies in the row behind me discussed the properties of whey protein, an exchange that lasted from takeoff to somewhere over the Carolinas. They projected their voices and spoke with the kind of enthusiasm found in infomercials. No one could possibly find this interesting, not even them. Now revise the conversation slightly, change protein drinks to, illegal steroids, and make the health food store a warehouse in Chinatown, and you've got something. Take it a step further and change bench pressing to organ harvesting, and I will gladly stow away my novel, sit back, and follow along. As it happens, though, the ones with the most interesting stories rarely speak loud. Sometimes you'll overhear a gem, like, "Susan, at some point we have to return that child." But for the most part, it's just pointless noise dialed up to a higher volume. In movie theaters, though, the chatter leans toward film analysis, a topic that makes any moderately educated person sound like an asshole. Place any two people in front of an empty screen and they assume the roles of Siskel and Ebert. As such, they tend to dress up their conversations with scholarly language, using terms like self-aware and referring to movies as exercises. I find myself cheering on those who just tell it straight, like the woman in front of me who ended a discussion on Argo by spitting out a fingernail and calling Ben Affleck a douche, or the teenager who summed up Zootopia by saying, "I don't care if it won an Oscar, I'm not fucking seven anymore." Last night, Amanda and I saw the film Sing Street in a small independent theater in the suburbs. Sitting behind us were a man and a woman. I didn't notice them when I sat down, but once I settled in, their voices rose above the din, and I was treated to my own personal radio show. Tonight's episode was called Who's That Actress? "The one from the film about the train in India. Oh, she's good," said the woman. "You mean the one with Redford and Streep?" This from the man. "No, it's not a train. It's a hotel. Why was I thinking train? Oh, you mean the woman from Misery. What's her name? Karen Bates? Is that her? The one who played the queen? The one who played the queen? With the red hair?" Normally, I would have simmered with rage, hating these people twofold. First, for not remembering the actress's name, and then for being so vocal about it. But as it were, I liked this couple. I couldn't see their faces, but given the clumsy amble of their dialogue, I placed them somewhere in their late 60s. Had they been younger than me, I would have turned around and threatened them with violence. But it's kind of sweet when older folk bobble a piece of pop culture knowledge. I could have just said, "Dame Judi Dench," and brought an end to the entire mystery. But as an audience member, I enjoy being one step ahead of the characters I'm following. It's a common narrative technique that draws us into a story and heightens suspense. The ticking bomb in the suitcase. The woman who hides her terminal illness from her lover. The name of an Oscar-winning actress that escapes two people sitting in a movie theater. Eventually, they moved on to another topic, and I got up and went to the concession stand. On my way back, I got a visual of the man. Narrow face, round eyeglasses, gray hair pulled into a ponytail, a horseshoe mustache. The woman sitting on the other side of him remained obscured. I sat down and handed Amanda a Diet Coke. She showed me her phone. On the screen was a picture from some realtor website. Amanda said something about an open house on Sunday, but that was drowned out by this loud, creaking sound. The voice of the woman behind me. "Did you grow up around Boston?" the woman said. I had originally pegged these two as a married couple, empty nesters probably, but given this type of get-to-know-you banter, it seemed more like a first date. Were they widowers? Divorcees? Or a pair of lonely hearts who, after a lifetime of searching, had finally found each other? "Boone, Iowa," the man replied. "It's a little town about 50 miles north of Des Moines." The woman said, "Ah." I mean, how else does one respond to Boone, Iowa? I turned my head slightly, trying to get a visual of the woman, when Amanda held out her phone again, this time showing me a picture of a different house. "Needham," she whispered. 1,500 square feet, but only one bathroom." I looked down at her screen, but instead of a ranch-style home, all I could see was a water tower, looming before a Midwestern sky, the name Boone stenciled across it. "My sister Gail married a man from Kansas City," the woman said. He owned a small manufacturing company that made medical devices before he retired. His son Wade runs it now, so that's nice. There was a pause. I felt like more was coming. Amanda said something about emailing the realtor, but my attention was on Wade. The woman continued, "And what do you do for work?" Amanda asked if I'd heard back from my sister about Memorial Day. I shushed her. The man behind me replied, "I was a high school history teacher for 31 years. Now I work in retail, where I make minimum wage." It was a bombshell of a plot twist. The history teacher bit, yeah, that worked. But why retail? And why now? Wouldn't he be tenured? Collecting a pension? To that end, wouldn't he still be teaching? And if not, was he fired? And then the way he tacked on, "where I make minimum wage," so matter of fact, as though it was part of his job title. Not a trace of bitterness or shame. I mean, why not just tell her he was a retired history teacher and leave it at that? It wasn't a lie, just like the time I told a date that I lived in Newton, but selectively left out the part about it being my parents' house. There had to be more to this story. Just then, I noticed I held a piece of popcorn in my hand. I'd been clutching it for the last 5 minutes and had compressed it into a small bit of yellow styrofoam, matted with skin oil and liquid butter. I dropped it on the floor and wiped my hand on my pant leg. "Which retail store?" the woman said. "Petco," replied the man. "The one on Waverly Street. I work 4 nights a week. It's okay, but my manager, she can be a little, I don't know. I guess she's just doing her job." I imagined this man with his gray ponytail, dressed in a blue polo shirt with the Petco logo stitched on his breast, standing behind the register, his finger hovering over one of the buttons, his eyeglasses on the tip of his nose. He is lost, frightened. Next to him is an impatient young woman who holds a massive set of keys. Ask him why he left teaching, I thought. I had to know. I felt Amanda's hand on my leg. She shook her head and mouthed, "Stop listening to them. It's rude." Rude? I was sitting in my chair, staring straight ahead. Their conversation was loud and inescapable. The only way I could appear uninterested was to read something on my phone or talk to Amanda about real estate. Why should I be forced into one of these alternate options just to give these people a sense of privacy? And then the man spoke again. "I became a teacher to get out of Vietnam. It was either that or move to Canada." Now Amanda froze. Her head stayed straight, but her pupils swung in my direction. Another wrenching plot twist. This one challenging my allegiance to the main character. Though he certainly wasn't the only young man who'd objected to the war, fleeing from combat isn't the most noble of things. On the other hand, divulging this to someone you hardly knew, much less on a date, was courageous. These are the ambiguities that make great characters. Do I like him or not? The answer lies somewhere between the two, in that complicated and murky space, prompting fierce discussions among audience members as they filter out of the theater. There was a pause, and then the woman said, "My older brother was killed in Vietnam." The lights went down just then, and the theater's logo animated on screen in bright colors and with a deafening jingle. This was followed by the coming attractions, which were a handful of trailers, all indie films, all with the same basic plot line: 4 quirky 30-somethings and how they navigate the obstacles of love, friendship, and adulthood. The story that I really wanted to see, though, was sitting right behind me.
Ben, I like that one.
Yeah, it's not bad.
No. Before we dig into the meat of what that story meant to me.
Let me just get a piece of gum so I can keep thinking for a second. Okay. Form your opinion. Oh, fuck.
So, yeah, before we get into the meat of what that story means to me, you know, what I touched on in the intro, just talk about a few other things that, like, I mean, I think this goes for most people, except for the assholes that talk and make a lot of noise. Like, my when I go into a movie theater and, you know, I'm going to have my time to check out of real life for a little bit and enjoy the movie, I like no distractions. I like complete silence because I have that high.
Me too.
Yeah, I know you do. And because, you know, because that's my expectation of what the experience is going to be like. It's like any sound becomes magnified. You know, if there's somebody opening a box of Mike and Ike's in the far corner of the theater, the flap of that box is in my ear hole when that person is opening it.
Yeah.
You know?
Uh-huh.
One of my favorites was this guy. Nothing crazy, but he... This woman had like one of those candy corn cones and like the cellophane, and she was just enjoying the shit out of it, and she just crinkling her wrapper and everything, you know, right in the middle of the movie. And he just leaned over and he shushed her wrapper crinkling. I just wanted to hug him after he did that. You
good
know?
For him. Good for him. I'm like scared about those kind of confrontations, but good for him.
One time I was in this is a while back, like. When the Lord of the Rings movies came out.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in the theater with a couple friends, and there was like a group of kids behind me, and we were seeing the movie near a college. And they were like, clearly, you know, a few college kids, and they weren't even that rowdy, but they were just kind of having, you know, some conversation as the movie was just starting.
Yeah.
And I turned around and I told them, you know, to shut up or whatever, you know, because the movie's starting, duh, you know. And then I proceeded to, like, fall asleep within the first 5 minutes of the movie.
Probably snored through the whole thing. Yeah, I don't know. The main question, I mean, and again, this was originally called, this little journal entry, the first word I wrote when I actually wrote it in my journal a year ago today was called, it was just said eavesdropping.
Right.
And that's all, you know, I just hearing the things people say, but some people talk loud.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. Like,
well, there's different reasons why people talk loud, but I know the type of loud talkers that you're talking about.
If you're in a club and you know,
or you're hard of hearing.
Yeah. I mean,
you're nervous, your heart rate's going
course,
up, you talk louder.
But the main question it comes down to for me is, do some people do it with not being aware that they're doing it? Or are people aware that they speak that loud and they're just totally inconsiderate? I have a feeling I don't know.
I think it's a combination. I mean, I love to think the worst of people and that they have like malicious intent for everything they do, which is obviously not the case. But I think there are a lot of people out there, and some of the people you gave examples of in your story, that like they're putting on a show for whoever their temporary hostage audience is. They're doing it in a way where they're trying to like. I don't know, make themselves feel better about who they are, or I don't know, like, you know, the guy in the elevator, you know?
I mean, like, and that happens, not constantly, but that's happened a few times. Men and women, you know, like, just like, they get on there, they step on an elevator and they keep talking.
Or on the train.
Or on the train, yeah. And you know, and it's just, or in line at the grocery, or at any store, you know, and it's like, I mean, sure, maybe it's that important of a conversation, but like...
Well, I'm just thinking about it, if I'm going to be totally honest. I mean, I've done it before.
You've done it
myself.
Too, and so have I.
Like,
so
I remember I started a business a couple years ago, and like, I'd have a call with my business partner about whatever we were, you know, we make music for commercials, and I'd be in a space where like, all of a sudden I was like, oh, here's an opportunity for me to flaunt this cool job that I think that I have, you know what I mean? And I'm going to talk loud about, oh yeah, we need to do that. Yeah. You just bring the piano down a little bit, whatever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and I was definitely putting on a show for who the fuck ever.
Frank
you know?
Used to do this thing where he would be, remember when I told you the thing about when we walked to Harvard Square, he used to do a thing when, if we're walking through a street, he would buy and sell imaginary stocks on his phone as he was walking past people. You know, he'd be like, listen, you know, 400 shares of Converse, keep it quiet. I had no idea what he was talking about. But yeah, I've done it too. Everybody's done it. It's not like a major thing. It's just that like, I was at a diner recently with Sarah and Tito. My in-laws were in town visiting. And I mean, see, this is where it becomes, it's not just a nuisance. It can really like bring a stop to what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because I went to this place, Cabot's. We all went there for lunch on Washington Street. It's like a diner, and it's kind of like an old school place where you know, there's always a, it was a Saturday afternoon and the place was busy. And they don't have a real good system of, like, getting a table. You basically have to stand. You don't put your name in and then right. go sit out in, the, like, the vestibule. You have to, like, just stand in line and keep your place in line until a table opens up.
Right.
So we're in there, and there's four of us. And the other thing that kind of sucks about the place, it's a great place, but they don't have good space for where you're going to wait in line. And I always get anxious in places like that because, you know, like, we're there waiting for a table, but, like, there's no good line system set up. So, you know, I can't really pay attention to what the person's telling me because I got one eye on the, you know, on the, I don't want to get cut, you know what I mean?
Right, you want to get nudged, so you're looking for the people passing.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, I just don't, I don't
it's
want
to. Very relaxed.
I don't, it's not relaxing at all. So I can't really, but Tito's the most relaxed guy in the world, and he's telling me something, and I'm trying to have a conversation with him, but then these two people, this young couple, I don't know if they were in high school or college, I can't tell the difference anymore, but they were young and they came in. And the girl was talking about how she broke her phone. But, I mean, I have to tell you, I shit you not, it was so loud. And she had such a unappealing voice, you know, that, like, she was about 5 feet from me. And Tito was trying to tell me something. And I hadn't seen him in a while. And he's telling me about his job, you know, or something important. And I'm, like, trying to listen to him. But we couldn't walk to the other side of the restaurant because we had to keep our place in line. So eventually, I just had to look at Tito. I was like, dude, I'm sorry. I can't listen. You got to stop talking. And he knew what I was talking about because he could hear it, you know?
Right.
And he just laughed and he was like, okay, man.
you had a little more hypersensitivity to the situation. Yeah.
I couldn't do it. I mean, it's like the rapper in the thing. But I don't know. Maybe that's just, I had a friend of mine. We're not friends anymore. He's like a Tea Party Republican, this kid. We had a falling out a few years ago. The political difference between us got so harsh. But we would meet for coffee and he would like sit, we'd go to like Starbucks and he would sit and he would talk, he would go on
his rhetoric.
Yeah. He would go on these like anti-women rants and like anti-liberal things.
Yeah.
And we'd be in Newton at coffee shops and people would be turning around and looking at us.
Right.
And it was so embarrassing, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, for me and for me to him and all this, I just wanted to get the hell out of there. And the funny thing is that this is nothing really to do with this story, but he's gotten like thrown out of like five coffee shops in the area. And I mean, that's when, you know, like I get like getting thrown out of a bar is one thing, but when you're getting thrown out of a coffee shop. So eventually, I think it was the last time I met him before we got into before I was like, yeah, where do you want to meet for coffee? You want to go to the Starbucks in Newtonville? And he's like, actually, you know, can we go to the Dunkin's over on Waltham?
I'm banned from the...
I'm banned. He was banned from every coffee shop.
I think what happens is we're talking about it more, and I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about myself when I've done stuff like that. It's a type of person or a person gets into a situation where they feel like all eyes are on them for some unknown reason.
Yeah, it could have something to do with it.
You know what I mean? When they're not. And then they feel like they've got to perform, and they're either going to seek out like some kind of negative attention, or they think they're going to say something that's going to garner like positive attention.
But do they feel like they have to perform, or do they want to perform?
I think it's.
I mean, who
it's
knows? I
think
guess,
it's.
But,
I
know,
think it's both, and I think sometimes people do it more actively, like you know, when they're really just seeking attention. Some people do it kind of like they get that paranoid feeling, like the people in wherever
people
they are
remember.
Looking at them, and they've got to do something. You know what I mean? And that's happening more like on a subconscious level than it is.
I better tell an interesting story about my screen lock.
Right.
Now, you know, the other thing too, it's just, you know, because these stories are always about my shit, just as much as they're, you know, about my. What I see, but I mean, I'm an irritable guy. You know what I mean? Like there are plenty of times when I'm with a man and I'm like, shh, you know, we're just having a regular conversation because there's five people next, you know, like 10 feet away or something.
I know
like,
that
I don't
about
know,
you.
Man.
I mean, I know from having irritable. Eaten in many restaurants with you that.
Do I
you,
do that?
Well,
do
you're
that
one,
you?
You are not a loud talker. You're a quiet talker. And I get the feeling that like, you don't want, like you say in the story, I don't get the feeling. I mean, I heard you say it in the story, but you don't want other people to know your thoughts.
It's funny because we're on a podcast right now and I basically bare my soul in
thoughts,
these stories.
Yeah.
But it is true. I don't want, but why? I mean, why is that? Why is it, you know?
I think when we're in public spaces,
I don't want people to know what
it's
I'm
a,
saying.
It can be a really tough thing because like right now we're in control. I mean, we don't know
who's
going to download the thing or who's going to listen to it, but we're actively making the decision to put our thoughts out there, you know, and be honest about what's going on with us. Whereas, you know, when you're in a public space, like some topic might come up that is a little touchy and all of a sudden you're going to have to divulge something in front of other people and they could potentially hear it when you really don't want to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I guess that's rational. explanation behind it. But I mean, I thought this was a funny. This was a funny instance because, my gosh, I remember obviously the story that prompted the whole thing was the older couple at the at the movie theater. And that's, you know, when I go to like Waltham movie theater or West Newton, it tends to be skew on like the older demographic. And they seem to be the people who really don't give a shit about what they're saying.
No, and
which
they're
is
not
great.
Performing. They're just, it's not even crossing their mind.
It's great, but
they're just going to say, hey, well, who's that on the screen?
Yeah,
and what happens? Is that his brother?
Yeah. It's great. And this story, I just remember being like, first going from, you know,
rage.
Amanda was drifting in and out. Starting with like a rage thing and then going from like the minimum wage thing, you know, and I was just like, and feeling like that's what drew me into the story.
I mean, that's such a great moment in the story because it seems like such a mundane detail, but really, especially on a first date.
Yeah. Well, if it was a first date, I'm assuming it was.
It seems like it was, right?
It was. Yeah.
So on a first date, in my mind, you're going to do one of three things. If you just want to have sex with the person, you're going to project yourself in a way that in your mind is like impressive, is going to make them want to sleep with you, whatever that may be. Usually it doesn't work. If you're on a first date and it's not working out, you know, you're going to try to say something outlandish so you can offend the person and basically end the thing.
Right.
But if you really do like the person and you see potential in the relationship,
you're going to open up.
All of a sudden you're going to be vulnerable you should, because if this thing moves along, you don't want to give the person, sell them on some false notion of yourself that then you're going to have to maintain that facade throughout the rest of the relationship. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you got two older people there that have probably been on many dates and been in many relationships.
They don't give a
shit.
And
they know that that's what's got to happen. So it's like that little moment, even though it's just a small little thing, it's a potentially embarrassing thing. It's not something that's going to make you be like, oh, let's cut this movie short and let's go to the bedroom. You're making minimum wage at Petco. He was basically saying to her, listen, this is where I'm at, like, and the fact that you describe it as being said, you know, without a twinge of embarrassment, like, he's like, this is where I'm at. Take me for who I am, you know, if you're interested.
Well, and that's, I think, just to bring it back to how you opened up this whole thing, you know, when you were talking about, you know, intimacy in conversation and today between people in general. And I don't mean like you and your wife's relationship necessarily. I mean, you guys are obviously have a comfort level between the two of you, but the way you related it to social media, you know, especially, and like, you know, I'm not going to go on a social media rant right now.
No.
I'm not going to do that. But like, obviously there is, you know, there is the facade people put up on. I don't know if I'm not even gonna say it's deliberate. I'm not indicting people. I'm just saying like people put certain things up there. And obviously in this day and age right now, you know, people attach themselves to a lot of causes and there's nothing wrong with those things. But it was so refreshing. And this was a year ago that this thing, it was so refreshing to hear from both of them. It wasn't just the guy who kind of bared his soul, but you know, like my brother was killed in Vietnam. I didn't make that up. I mean, and literally, and I'm not even making it that up. Like, I don't have an imagination that is that good. You know, like the lights went down and the movie started right after that. It was, you couldn't have wrote
written
it better.
But
it was so refreshing to see like zero pretense.
Right. And because the information they were sharing was not grandiose, but it held weight. Because it was
jarring, man.
Yeah.
It held weight. I mean, absolutely. Because it was
gravity.
It was so genuine.
Yeah.
And that was the first part that went in the journal. It was just straight up, this is what I overheard
that
last night.
Between those
two
people.
And then I just sort of, that became from there, like, well, what are these other moments? You know, it was funny that ended up being something I was very interested in, so much so that Amanda was, we were at the beginning stages of trying to buy a house then, and she was like, well, do you want to see this? I was like, shh. Shut up. It was the exact opposite of the Tito thing with the diner I was talking about. But and then that just went into these other instances where I know they just happen to everybody when you're in line or you're forced into a place, a space with somebody, and they're, man, the guy on the elevator or the woman on the elevator, it's just, I mean, like, that is a real case of grandstanding, what you have to say. It's like, shut up. I mean, like, it's so apparent, like, anyway.
Right, yeah, no, I agree, and I think the reason why it's so off-putting is because, at least for me, is because I see that type of talking, that type of expressing oneself, I see it myself, and not so much now, but I remember it myself because I was into saying things that I felt were shocking because, you know, I was being honest and, like, you know, I kind of like prided myself on that kind of attitude, whereas other people, you know, like kept everything inside and they weren't okay with themselves,
right,
because, you know, they weren't just blurting it out.
Right.
In reality, like doing something like that, like fast and a furious, like, you know, like a more violent expulsion of kind of intimate details, really, you're not being that honest, because you're almost like, it's almost like you're creating an explosion to distract the listener from what's really going on behind whatever you're saying.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in relating it back to, you know, what I was talking about in the beginning and learning how to have quiet, slow, vulnerable conversations where you're not going to let your emotions overtake you to where you start shouting down the other person or talking at a quicker pace. Like, you're really thinking about what you're saying because you want whatever you're talking about, you want some progression or some growth or something positive to happen around it. Learning how to do that is really important, obviously, and is just so counter to, like, the way I think we feel we need to express ourselves, you know. And I think social media feeds that. I think watching television, the news feeds that. You know, everybody that's putting their point out there is putting it out there in such an aggressive way.
Yeah. No, that's another thing, too, just the idea of listening, which you're maybe not directly alluding to.
But
there,
that's right.
But
it's part of what I'm talking about.
I know people. I'm not even, I mean, I can't say that I'm a really good listener, but I know people who, a few people who are. But yeah, it is a lost art, listening, but hopefully not lost on you, dear listeners. It's another episode of The Greater Fool. is there anything else with this thing? That was a pretty good thing. I mean,
I think that
that was better than the last one.
I think that's good.
So that's going to do it for this edition of The Greater Fool Speaks. And just kind of in closing, you know, it's funny because this story was really just my little investigation into how people talk, you know, in the broadest sense, how some people talk loud, some whisper, you know, some people want their conversations heard and others don't. And I write these essays primarily as observations, but also because it's, you know, there's something fundamentally that I want to understand. Normally, I'm a central character in these stories, and therefore it's usually my flaws that I try to understand, or my motives or my truths that I, you know, seek or whatever. But the funny thing is, in this story, I'm literally just an observer. And I think, first of all, my irritability really comes through, but more importantly, after you and I just spoke here, and I, you know, heard your thoughts on the skillfulness of conversation, especially, you know, the vulnerability of intimacy, it made me realize how much I need to learn when it comes to human contact. And it's funny, and maybe that's why I like to write stories, you know, I don't know, because their stories are kind of like the overbearing talker in a public space. Stories are really one-way conversations. I mean, I think they are. That's what I'm thinking right now. I mean, in a perfect world, it's sort of it's a two-way thing in a kind of a metaphysical way, but really they're one-way conversations. And when you had mentioned what I really liked, what really kind of turned my attention up, when you had mentioned the slow progress of conversation as opposed to the explosion of making a statement.
Yeah.
That really resonated me because I know that I'm lacking in that department, and I didn't quite realize it until you said that. And, you know, particularly with my wife, with Amanda, with other friends, with colleagues, you know, whoever. And yeah, I mean, that's just, it's important to come clean with that kind of stuff. You know, just because I write an essay in no way presupposes that I'm an authority on the subject. I mean, you know, this is, whatever you want to call it, this is a journey, or, you know, it's what the assholes in the story would call an exercise. But, you know, it takes work to be a productive listener, and that's what I really appreciated that you brought to this, that I write the story. I don't really know what to kind of how to make sense of it, and you helped a great deal with that. So, You know, it takes work to become a good listener. I have a lot of that cut out for me. So I think I'm going to get out of here and get to it, man. Let's just close it up, man. Thanks, everybody. If anybody wants to send us a note or an idea or a suggestion.
Or a story of their own.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is about storytelling. If you have a story and you want to come on and join us for a conversation, please let us know. You know, it's an interactive thing. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to have you in here. The email is thegreaterfoolpodcast@gmail.com. Come and tell us a good story, man. Anyway, I'm Danny Pellegrini.
And I'm Dylan Schwartz. And this is The Greater Fool Speaks.
We'll see you next time. Thanks, guys.
Take it easy. Thank you.